We are starting a new sermon series today entitled Something's Gotta Give. And as I was thinking about and praying about what to where to go after Easter, I had had a plan in place. I like to try to plan out my preaching a little bit. But as we got into Lent and closer, I realized that there was probably going to be a course correction, as happens sometimes. And so I just started praying about, okay, where you want me to go, God? And I started thinking about where we are in our world and even in the life of our church where we even might be on our individual journeys. And if you're anything like me, I've gotten to the point where on the one hand, I'm tired of talking about and hearing about the last few years. If I never hear the word pandemic or COVID again, I will be fine with that. On the other hand, it's one of those things where if we try to pretend like it didn't happen, that's almost irresponsible because it did. And it's definitely left an imprint on our lives and on our experiences. And the last few years are really, we talked about this a few weeks ago, which I think was really where this came to a head in my thinking and in my praying, where I was talking about just feeling like we're spinning our wheels. It feels like we're stuck. We've technically come out of the pandemic, but in many areas of our lives, it almost feels like we're still there. We've come back, we've been back for a while, but it doesn't feel the same. And I get the sense that if that's going to change, and it may not feel the same as it used to, but if it's at least going to feel like things are moving, something's got to give. Just like when you're spinning your wheels in the mud, in order for you to get out of that, something's going to have to give. And as I was praying about that, and God led me to a book in the Old Testament that was not even on my radar. But I think, I really believe that has a lot of parallels to where we find ourselves, and that's the book of Nehemiah. Nehemiah is interesting, as well as the Old Testament. I'm fascinated with the Old Testament to begin with. Nehemiah is interesting because the events that take place in Nehemiah, even though the book comes in the first half of the Old Testament, which is a good reminder to me that the Old Testament isn't necessarily chronological. Malachi is not the last. That's not how that works. The events of Nehemiah are really possibly some of the last things that happen in the Old Testament period before we hit the 400 years of silence between the Old and New Testaments. And we meet Nehemiah at a point in Israel's history where the people of God are returning to Jerusalem after having been in exile for 70 years. And we've talked about the story when we were in the series on lament in Lamentations. That's what Jeremiah is lamenting. The impending half of the kingdom of Israel has already gone into exile. The other half is about to go into exile. And that's what he's lamenting is the fact that due to their disobedience, and not just they got one thing wrong one time, this was a pattern of disobedience. God was going to take them from the place where he had placed them and promised them to somewhere they did not want to be. And it was not going to be like they were grounded for a week or two. It was going to be it was going to be 70 years before they got to see their homeland again. And God told them at the beginning, he said, you probably are going to want to get comfortable because, you know, build homes, start families, pray for the peace and the prosperity of where I'm sending you because you're going to be there a while. And they were 70 years. So when you read that verse from Jeremiah about I have plans to prosper you, that wasn't going to happen overnight. That was at the beginning of the 70 years that God was communicating that. It wasn't necessarily great news to the people of Israel, but it was the answer that they got from God. And while they're in exile, Jerusalem didn't just sit there uninhabited. it was basically taken over by the people who had invaded and destroyed. They basically crushed the city. So you just think about what it must have been like for the people of God. Try to put yourself in their shoes as they go into exile because of their own disobedience. You get taken out of your home, the place that you love, and you're not just sent, you're hauled off to a place that is nothing like everything that you've come to enjoy and know. And then decades later, you're allowed to start returning back to the place that you were taken from, except when you get there, it doesn't look anything like it did when you left. The city is in ruins. Now you go find your house, if it's still standing, and there's somebody else living in it. It would be the Old Testament equivalent of a squatter. And they've moved in the 70 years that you've been gone, and they don't want to leave. Understandably so. Nobody's been in this house for 70 years. So you kind of get a little bit of a picture. Pardon me. You get a little bit of a picture of what the people of God have experienced and what they're going through. And then Nehemiah comes into the story. Now, by this point, the exile had been over for almost 100 years. They were in exile for 70 years, and for the last 100 years, they've been allowed to start returning, which sounds funny, because that's a long time. And they do. They start returning really in two large waves of people that have returned to Jerusalem. The first one was led by Zerubbabel, and I hope I don't have to say his name again in this series. And the second was by Ezra. Now, if you want to know the events that lead up to what we read in Nehemiah, read the book of Ezra, which conveniently comes right before the book of Nehemiah. It really sets the stage, sets the context of where Israel, the people of Israel, are at this point. And in fact, in the Hebrew scripture, Ezra and Nehemiah, those stories are so closely related, it's one book. It's one continuous story that's told. And over that time, as they come back, work has been going on to rebuild the city and get things back in order. And there has been one major accomplishment led by Ezra. The temple's been rebuilt and rededicated, which, I mean, makes sense that would be... The people of Israel are spiritual people. They have been brought together by God. The temple is their spiritual center. And so that was the first focus that they had of rebuilding the temple. But the walls and the gates and really the rest of the city by and large was still in ruins. Somewhere along the line, the work had just hit, I chuckle to use this word, the work to rebuild the wall had hit a wall. Now, it's likely that Nehemiah has never seen Jerusalem. You just consider the timeline. They were in captivity for 70 years, in exile for 70 years. It's been 100 years since they've been allowed to return, to start to return to Jerusalem. I have a hard time believing that Nehemiah was 175 plus years old. So it's likely he's never seen the city. But he's heard the stories. He knows that this is the city of God, that this is, he's heard of the splendor of the city. And we're going to find out here in just a little bit what he has actually been up to this entire time. But in the meantime, as he's where he is, one of his brothers comes to visit him along with a group that had returned to Jerusalem. And he asks them, hey, how are things going in Jerusalem with the people who've returned? And this is the answer that he gets from his brother and the people there in verse 3 of chapter 1. They said to me, things are not going well. That's a good place to start. Yeah. Things are not going well for those who return to the province of Judah. They are in great trouble and disgrace. The wall of Jerusalem has been torn down and the gates have been destroyed by fire. When I heard this, and this is Nehemiah talking, I sat down and wept. In fact, for days, I mourned, fasted, and prayed to the God of heaven. So even though Nehemiah has likely never seen the city, This is tragic news for him. And he, in this moment, you get the sense that Nehemiah realizes that something's got to change. And we'll find out he's kind of in a position to do some of that and to help some of that out. You could say that it was his something's got to give moment. And his heart just begins to stir for this city that he's never seen. And his mind begins to turn, and God begins to do something in Nehemiah. He doesn't know it yet, but God is going to do something through him and use him to do something that he could never do on his own. And I think that's, God wants to do the same thing with us, with you, with me. And even though we might find ourselves, and may even currently find ourselves, in situations or in times where it just feels like something's got to give, and even though that something that has to give seems like it's just beyond us, there's good news here, and that's that God is here to help us. In fact, He wants to do that. He wants to do things in and through us that we could never do on our own. In fact, that's almost, well, I was going to say, I would say almost always. No, that is always how anything of eternal impact happens, is if God does it through us, because we can't do that. And that's really what this great story of Nehemiah is about. It's a reminder through Nehemiah to the people of God that it's possible what they had been trying to pull off this entire time, they were doing in their own strength. They weren't relying on God, and so God uses Nehemiah to remind them. And it's an encouragement for us who sometimes feel like we're stuck where we've just had enough, and we're sick and tired of being sick and tired, that doesn't mean that that hope is lost, because God is here. And He's not just here, He's here to help us. And when Nehemiah gets this news, he just begins to weep. In fact, it says he mourned, fasted, and prayed to the God of heaven for days, which is an understatement, because it was actually months. And we can calculate how long he has been doing this, because we didn't read it, but if you go back and read the first part of the book, it says that the story begins in the fall. It begins... Where am I? There I am. It begins in late autumn, in the month of Kislev. When we get to chapter 2, which is where Nehemiah kind of starts moving into action, that was the following spring in the month of Nisan, which is a period of 4 months. That's kind of incidental. God could have done this in Nehemiah overnight, but it just gives you a picture of how long Nehemiah fasted and prayed. And it's the first thing he does when he finds out this news from back home, that things are not going well in Jerusalem. He mourns, he fasts, he prays for 4 months. Listen to what it is. Listen to how he prays here in chapter 1. Then I said, O Lord God of heaven, the great and awesome God who keeps His covenant of unfailing love with those who love Him and obey His commands, listen to my prayer. Look down and see me praying night and day for your people Israel. I confess that we have sinned against you. Yes, even my own family and I have sinned. We have sinned terribly by not obeying the commands, decrees, and regulations you gave us through your servant Moses. Please remember what you told your servant Moses. If you are unfaithful to me, I will scatter you among the nations. But if you return to me and obey my commands and live by them, then, even if you are exiled to the ends of the earth, I will bring you back to the place I have chosen for my name to be honored. The people you rescued by your great power and strong hand are your servants. O Lord, please hear my prayer. Listen to the prayers of those of us who delight in honoring you. Please grant me success today by making the king favorable to me. Put it into his heart to be kind to me. In those days, I was the king's cupbearer. That's a full prayer. There's a lot in there. There is praise, which is always a good place to start. There is intercession on behalf of the people. And even more importantly than that, in this case, I think there's confession. He knows that he and his people have contributed to the situation they find themselves in, either in the past, because had they not gone into exile, they would not even be in this situation, or currently what's going on. And he says, look, we've messed up. The people have messed up. I've messed up. My entire family has messed up. We've played a role in this problem. And I think there's a very good lesson in there from Nehemiah. When we find ourselves in situations like this, I think our first tendency is to look around us and figure out who it is we can point the finger at. Who's the person that I can blame for what I'm going through right now? What's the group that I can complain about or throw under the bus for this situation? But I think the first, especially as those who the more and more we follow Jesus, the more and more humble we should be, the first place we need to look is in the mirror. Now, we might find out that we have been faithfully, but we also might find out that we have not been everything that we need to be. We might find out that we haven't been doing everything. We might find out that we have not been the kind and loving and gracious people that God has transformed us to be. And I think that might be the reason why that's not the first place we look in the mirrors, because we know what we're going to see. The good news is, though, again, we don't look in the mirror and God's not looking to condemn us. If we find out something that we don't want to know, or we find out that we have been contributing to the issue, God is gracious. He wants to fix that. He wants to heal us of that. He wants to start using us in a way that doesn't contribute to the problem, but contributes to a solution. And the good news on top of that is I believe that we all want that. We all have the desire and even the will many times to do and be better. And I think, at least in principle, we are moving in the right direction. But we are certainly not anywhere close to being there. You could argue we're just getting started. And we're definitely not in any place, I think, in the case of any church where they could pause and pat themselves on the back and say it's all good. I mean, we've got significant problems in our world, which are always going to be, as long as sin exists, we're going to encounter those. We've got obstacles in our churches. But the good news is, again, we know the answer. We have the answer. The answer is Jesus. Jesus is the medicine that we need for what ails us. But that doesn't mean it's easy. Just like if you've ever, we've actually been fortunate, Simon has enjoyed taking his ibuprofen because it's fruity. He likes the flavor. But if you've ever tried to give a kid medicine, sometimes it's hard to get him to swallow that. And in the same way, and I did not intend on making this rhyme, but it does, that sometimes Jesus is hard to follow. And if you have this picture of Jesus in your mind that's just meek, mild, who doesn't ask a whole lot of you, you need to get that out of your head, because the reality is this. The Jesus of the Bible is far more demanding than we think he is. He's gracious, but he's far more demanding than we would like to think. Living the Jesus kind of life is not a cakewalk. Sometimes in these situations, we find the thing that's got to give is something that we just have a hard time letting go or giving. And what's interesting about Nehemiah's case is, as you read this and as you really pay attention, is that Nehemiah gets the sense that it's very likely that in this situation, the thing that's got to give is Nehemiah himself. And at the end of chapter 1, if you caught it, I tried to slow down and read it so you didn't miss it, those last words, he says something very interesting. In those days, I was the king's cupbearer. So if you were wondering what Nehemiah has been up to this time, during this time, that's it. He's been living in the palace in a very, arguably, very important role serving the king as the cupbearer. Now, the cupbearer's job, main job, was to taste the wine that was brought to the king to make sure it wasn't poisoned. Now, the bad news of that is if it's poisoned, the cupbearer's out of a job. That's the least of his worries, but he's out of a job. The good news is that if the wine is good, then the cupbearer gets to enjoy a lot of good wine, which we as good Nazarenes don't know anything about, so we'll just keep moving. But that's the upside of the job. He gets the best. I mean, because they didn't bring cheap wine to the king. I mean, he got to enjoy some good wine. On top of that, he has a lot of access to the king. It's a very important role that he plays. And in fact, in many cases, the cupbearer ended up for a king becoming one of their most trusted confidants and companions because they knew that person was there to possibly give their life to keep the king safe. And that's kind of the situation that we see Nehemiah in. It was a significant role. And so he gets to know the king well, and the king, in turn, really gets to know Nehemiah well. He learns how to read him. He knows how to gauge how things are going by Nehemiah's demeanor and his facial expressions. When Nehemiah walked into a room, the king could gauge how things were by Nehemiah's mood, which explains how one day when Nehemiah walks in, bringing the king his wine, the king notices that Nehemiah is just not himself. And we all know how that goes. We know somebody well, and we can just tell when they're having a hard time with something. And the king is apparently not a cruel person because he asked him, hey, what's going on? What's wrong? And so Nehemiah tells him, and that's where we pick the story up in chapter 2. 4 months after, Nehemiah gets this word from his brother and the others who had come from Jerusalem. After four months of him crying out and pouring out his heart to God, we pick up the story in chapter 2. Early the following spring, in the month of Nisan, during the 20th year of King Artaxerxes' reign, I was serving the king his wine. I had never before appeared sad in his presence. So the king asked me, "Why are you looking so sad? You don't look sick to me. You must be deeply troubled." Then I was terrified, but I replied, "Long live the king. How can I not be sad? For the city where my ancestors are buried is in ruins, and the gates have been destroyed by fire." The king asked, "Well, how can I help?" With a prayer to the God of heaven. I love that line because I can just picture Nehemiah. You ever get yourself in a situation where you want to make sure the right words come out of your mouth, and so you sigh and internally you whisper a prayer. That's an age-old thing. Nehemiah did that. With a prayer to the God of heaven, I replied, "If it pleases the king, and if you are pleased with me, your servant, send me to Judah to rebuild the city where my ancestors are buried." The king, with the queen sitting beside him, asked, "How long will you be gone, and when will you return?" After I told him how long I would be gone, the king agreed to my request. I also said to the king, "If it pleases the king, let me have letters addressed to the governors of the province west of the Euphrates River, instructing them to let me travel safely through their territories on my way to Judah. And please give me a letter addressed to Asaph, the manager of the king's forest, instructing him to give me timber. I will need it to make beams for the gates of the temple fortress, for the city walls, and for a house for myself." And the king granted these requests because the gracious hand of God was on me. So the king is moved. He sees Nehemiah come in. He can tell that something's not right with Nehemiah. They've got a kind of relationship where it's not just, you know, king and subject. He's at least moved enough and cares enough to ask what Nehemiah is going through. So he asks him what's wrong. Nehemiah tells him, gives him his request, and the king grants everything he asks for. Why? Well, Nehemiah knew exactly why the king granted everything. And he tells us at the end there, because the gracious hand of God was on me. You notice how he ended his prayer, please make the king incline his heart to be kind to me and grant me everything that I request. God didn't leave out a detail, granted that request completely. Nehemiah hears things are not good back home. He puts his own future on the line. I mean, literally he does. He lays it all out before the king. This is his something's got to give moment. The way the rebuilding in Jerusalem had been going was going to have to change. Things that they hadn't been doing, they were going to have to start. Things that they had been doing, they were probably going to have to stop some of those things. It was a moment of clarity for Nehemiah. That didn't just come on a whim. Remember, it came after 4 months of him seeking the face of God, of crying out to God. It was a moment where he knew what had to happen. He knew what he had to do in that moment. And he knew that God was going to use him to do this. That's where this first chapter and a half brings us to the story of Nehemiah. So a few observations about this story. Five to be exact. And a few questions to think about as we go through. The first is, and this almost seems obvious, because it's where the story starts, Nehemiah sees something needs to change. That's the first thing that pops up. He asks the question, he gets the answer. Things are not going well. And it's very apparent to him from his brother's reaction just how bad things are. The people have been they've been coming back to Jerusalem for 100 years. The work has been going on for 100 years. Yes, the temple was rebuilt and dedicated, and there's almost an assumption in Nehemiah's question that he's going to get a positive answer. You ever ask the question, hey, how are things going? Oh, they're going well. I don't know that Nehemiah expected to hear what he heard from his brother. And you can understand, I mean, hey, they rebuilt the temple, they dedicated it. He could just assume that everything else was going the way that it should have been going. And then he finds out that's not the case, because the wall and the gates and everything else are still lying in ruins, basically. I mean, what good is it to rebuild the temple if there's no gate, if there's no wall to protect it? I mean, walls were arguably the most important part of an ancient city. If you rebuild the city, what good is it if it's just a sitting duck for your enemies to come in and take over? Nehemiah sees and he understands that somehow the people have just they've hit a rut. They're stuck. They're spinning their wheels, and something has to change. And my question out of this for us is, what is it? Either maybe in your own life, you look at the world around you and in the situation, maybe even among us, what is it that we see that needs to change? Where have you hit a wall? Where are your wheels spinning? What have you been thinking about and praying about that's troubling you and keeps troubling you? And it has just been weighing on you for a long time. What are you going to do with that? Where are you going to take that? what needs to happen? What's got to give? And the second observation, and this is a good lesson for us, we've talked about this, that in any of these situations, this is the first move we always make, is that Nehemiah seeks God first. We don't even see that he has a response for his brother and the rest of the group. He just says, I wept and I mourned and I fasted and I prayed for days to the God of heaven. Four months. We don't like to spend 4 minutes doing something that's not enjoyable or fun or that doesn't yield immediate results. 4 months, mourning, weeping, fasting, praying. When was the last time you prayed for 4 months for anything that you knew needed to change? When was the last time you had a burden on your heart so heavy that you were going to pray through that thing no matter how long it took? Nehemiah didn't know it was going to take 4 months. It could have taken 40 years when he started. So he seeks God first. Third observation is when he hears from God, we don't know exactly what Nehemiah hears from God. He doesn't let us in on that. But we do know that he got some direction because his next step is that he risked it all to obey God. Whatever it was that he heard from God, he had decided in that moment, something's got to give. Nothing can stand in my way here. He put his career, because you notice, the king asked him, when are you going to leave and how long are you going to be gone? And then when you hear what he asks for, the last thing he asks for is wood to build a house for himself. We don't know how long he told the king he was going to be gone, but it was going to be long enough he needed a place to live. The king, and so he's risking his livelihood. This this is a prestigious position, especially for someone who had been part of a people who'd been exiled. His livelihood, his position, his influence, he lays it all on the line. He is honest with the king about his concerns. And he knows how to approach the king. He's not going to bring it up. He's laid this all in God's hands. God, you move upon the heart of the king to be gracious and kind to me. And he gets that sign when the king asks him, Nehemiah, what's going on? You're just not yourself. Which might have been a question the king never asked. But it was such a unique situation. Nehemiah's like, rather than pausing and say, is this a sign, God? He lets him know. He just lays it all out. He knows the king could have laughed him out of the throne room or wherever it was that he was meeting him, or worse. How dare you whine to me about what's going on in your life? But this burden, this sense that something had to give, that God was going to use him to do something about the situation, it was worth more than the risk that he was going to take, and it was going to cost him dearly. It was going to impact his own personal resources. It was going to turn his home life upside down. Everything impressive, comfortable about Nehemiah's life was going to change. And it won't be long before word gets out about what Nehemiah is doing. He's the cupbearer. People probably know who he is. And that he's going to go back to Jerusalem, the city that's in ruins that he's never been to before. He's going to go back to help out. And the town's probably going to be mumbling, can you believe what Nehemiah is doing? He lives in the palace. He's going back to that place. There's a reason that not everybody has gone back yet. They don't want to go. And I wonder if anybody's ever said that about us. You know, like, can you believe what those people are doing? Can you believe what so-and-so is? So we would all admit that at least in some area of our life, there was something that could change. There's something that could be altered, something that really needs to change. And what if we do what Nehemiah did and we seek God and we pour out our hearts and we wait to listen and hear from Him, and then what He calls us to do is going to look weird as all get out to everybody who's looking at us? That's how it had to feel to Nehemiah. He laid it all on the line. Something had to give. And in Nehemiah's case, what had to give was Nehemiah. He had to be willing to give it all up. He sees a need for change. He spends 4 months fasting and praying, and he decides to put everything, even his life. I mean, he had gotten used to risking his life, you know, testing the wine, but this was a little different. He put it all, his career and all of its perks, he put it all on the line. Fourth observation, and this I think is almost more personal for me. Nehemiah asks for help. He wasn't afraid. Well, he was, I guess, a little bit, because he paused and he breathed that prayer to God before he let it out. But ultimately, he wasn't afraid to ask for help. He told the king very clearly, here's what I need. A lot of us would have just, if we had been in a situation we were like that, we would have just gone, oh no, I'm fine, I got this. You know, people come to us and they're genuinely concerned. Hey, what's going on? You're just not, something. I know you're not sick. Something's going on. We would look at them and go, oh, I'm fine. I'm good. No, I don't want to trouble you with this. I got this. I mean, what is it about us as human beings that we are afraid to ask for help, to admit to somebody that we've got a problem that we can't handle on our own in some area of our life? Is it pride disguised as false humility? Is it a misunderstanding of how God has created His body to function? Because God, you join a body when you join a new family when you become a Christian. And that body and that family supports one another. And if we talk about if one part of the body is not willing to do its part, the rest of the body suffers. Well, I think sometimes too, when one part of the body is suffering and it's not willing to ask for help from the rest of the body, that also causes the body to suffer. Imagine Nehemiah not asking the king for help. You know what would have happened? The same thing that had been happening for 100 years. They would have taken 2 steps forward, maybe 2-3 steps back. The walls would have still been in ruins. Nehemiah asks for help. And he doesn't just ask in some vague sense. I mean, these are very specific requests. Other than the amounts, these are very specific requests he has for the king. He was very specific about what he needed. And then the last observation, Nehemiah acknowledges God's blessing. He knows that it might have been the king might have been the avenue through which these requests were granted, but he knew that it was because God's hand was on him. And he knew that because he'd spent 4 months listening for God's voice. He recognized it. When God's hand moved, he knew it. He could sense it. He knew, and he had confidence and faith that God was going to do what he knew God had promised him along the line in that close conversations he was going to do. He didn't try to explain it away. He didn't say, well, I just happened to be in the right place at the right time. Caught the king on a good day. No. You caught the king on a good day because God put him in a mood to be gracious and kind to you. And Nehemiah knew that and he understood it. He had spent months praying and fasting and seeking God for this very thing. I think we, in a different context, obviously, I think most of us would agree we kind of find ourselves, it hasn't been 100 years, thankfully, but we find ourselves in a place after a few years where it feels like something's got to give. And it's not that things are, I mean, arguably, things were going okay because they were back in Jerusalem. They had the temple. They could go worship. I mean, they had that, so they were back, but they really weren't back. They were home, but it wasn't home. And I don't think that any of us would disagree that in a situation in your life, you look at something in the world, something's got to give. Maybe it's something in your own life. Maybe it's in our church. And I wonder if we realize that the reason we notice that is because just like Nehemiah realized it when his brother gave him the news, God was kind of putting his finger on Nehemiah and saying, this is it. I'm using your brother to tell you that something's got to change. Could it be that God wants to do something? That's why we have the sense that something needs to be different. And maybe you even know what needs to happen. Maybe you're Nehemiah in this church body. I don't know. And maybe you know you can't do it on your own. So what is it in your life that's got to give? What is it maybe within our church, within the world, within the church as a whole? What is it that you have a sense that God wants to do, but that something's got to give? What role have you and I played in getting us in a place where something's got to give? And if we don't know the answer to those questions, are we willing to seek God's face and maybe even mourn and fast and pray to hear from God what He has to say to us about those things? Are we willing to humble ourselves before Him for as long as it takes? I hope it doesn't take 40 years or 70 years or 100 years. Are we willing to accept whatever we hear from God? God called Nehemiah to leave his place in the palace to go back to his city that was in ruins. Are we willing to ask for help? Obviously, first of all, from God, but from each other. Are we willing to risk whatever it takes to see God do what we know He needs to do? And then when it happens, are we willing to give Him every last bit of the credit? I wonder if the king noticed that Nehemiah didn't say thank you at the end of that. He said thank you, but it was to someone else. I'm sure Nehemiah was grateful that the king was sensitive enough, but he knew. And that's the only gratitude he gives. And the king granted it because the gracious hand of the God of heaven, who I had been pouring my heart out to for months, that hand was on me. You bow your heads with me.